Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we meet the man who has to persuade rich countries to turn pledges into cash to help fight climate change in developing countries. Ibrahima Cheikh-Diong is very new to the job, so what's in his inbox?
Now, what I found is that there is a sense of urgency. There is a sense of raising more resources so we can actually meet the demand. But more importantly, there is a sense of ambition and desire to make sure we can begin to support the most vulnerable in the developing countries. And that's basically what drives the process right now since I came on board.
A United Nations panel is investigating war crimes in Sudan. Where does that process start? And a new-ish jihadi group is showing its teeth in northwestern Nigeria.
Lakurawa currently is not as advanced as Boko Haram, but I can assure you that it is Boko Haram 2.0 because, number one, they have huge experience in the Sahel already. They are heavily armed, but they also have drones which they deploy to surveil communities and the Nigerian military.
It's Wednesday, the 13th of November. First, we go to Azerbaijan. It's not a country we normally go to, but if it's November, it must be COP, the Conference of the Parties, which is the decision-making body of the United Nations on climate change. It meets every year in a different part of the world to discuss collective action to stave off further damage by climate change. There have been several in Africa: Nairobi in 2005, Durban in 2011, Marrakech in 2016, and Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt in 2022. This year, it's happening in Baku, in Azerbaijan. Last year, it was held in Dubai. Next year, it will be in Belém, in Brazil. The big conversation this year is all about the dollar, the dollar, the dollar bill. The money needed to fund the changes countries need to make to try and limit the damage caused by catastrophic changes in the climate. Those changes are caused by damaging carbon emissions, pollution, habitat loss, and many other factors. The poorest countries in the world do the least damage, but suffer the most loss. But no one is exempt from the effects. Everyone needs to do their bit, and that's where the money comes in. So this COP is being called the Money COP. And the money is to be funneled into projects via the Loss and Damage Fund, which was established last year. The man in charge of it is Ibrahima Cheikh-Diong. He hasn't been in the job for very long, but Wahiga Mwaura from Focus TV had a chance to talk to him about what's in his inbox. Wahiga downloaded some of that interview into this conversation with me. So, did you get a sense of the status of the fund?
Unfortunately, and not entirely, I did not get a full sense of the status of the fund, and I'll tell you why. So what I understood was the executive director outlined pledges that have been made, how hard stakeholders are working to follow up on these pledges of about $700 million, that a board has been set up, a host country, the Philippines, you know, is where the operations will be coming from. But as to how much money is actually in the bank as a result of these pledges, and by extension, when vulnerable countries impacted by climate change could expect to start receiving some of these funds, that the executive director remained very cagey about. And it does feel like a lot more should have been done. 2 years ago, the decision was made to actually establish this fund and operationalize it. It took a whole year before the pledges started coming in. So at the last COP in Dubai, the EU, the UK, others announced contributions to about $400 million. That's now risen to $700 million. But after that, it's unclear if any of these countries have met these pledges. So when I had a conversation with the man in charge, Ibrahima Cheikh-Diong, he's just been in office for less than a month. And I spoke to him yesterday. This is what he told me about his entry.
Now, what I found is that there is a sense of urgency. There is a sense of rapid response so we can support countries. There is a sense of raising more resources so we can actually meet the demand. But more importantly, there is a sense of ambition and desire to make sure we can begin to support the most vulnerable in the developing countries. And that's basically what drives the process right now since I came on board.
Well, you say that you found a sense of urgency awaiting you. But if you look at media reports over the last couple of months, I think the expectation had been different since the fund was established in Dubai. And there are some countries that have raised concerns about the pace at which the fund is being rolled out. I want to understand from you, have the funds not been forthcoming? Is that what you found? Are you able to just give us a sense of where we are with the fund?
You gotta understand, in Dubai, a promise was made to operationalize the fund, and that operationalization takes a different step. I'm sure by now, you certainly know about the progress we made, first of all, in having a board, because the board and the fund make the decision about the allocation of the funding, but also the funding decision, and that was extremely critical. The other part that was equally important is our pledges.
Well, before we move on, how much of the $700 million have you received?
In the business of pledges, first of all, the pledges were made, but what's important here in Baku, all that actually pledged actually have confirmed the pledges, and that's very important for us, at least to make sure that we still have the same commitment we had from Dubai. Now, as the executive director, one of my priority is to lead a fundraising drive so we can get actually more resources coming from different sources.
I don't mean to badger you, executive director, but any figure you can give us of how much you've received so far from an accountability perspective?
Again, we got $700 million of that been pledged. New pledges came up. Out of those $700 million,
yes,
as I said, as of today, there's a process is ongoing.
How much of the pledges have actually been received?
How much of the pledge,
of the $700 million?
$700 million.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've been confirmed by those who pledge them in Dubai. And again, we got some new pledges that actually came up here. And the idea is then, as we actually go through the process of converting those pledges into actual funding, obviously we're not stopping there. We're looking into the access modalities so that we'll be able at least to begin to at least get these resources out of the way to where it's actually needed so we can begin to be impactful.
Mr. Jong is in a difficult position, isn't he, Wahiga? Because this is requires a lot of diplomacy. It requires a lot of cajoling. It requires a lot of patience. It does appear that there are plenty of pledges, but probably not the money itself. So how can Mr. Jong and the fund make countries that have made those pledges pay up? Is there a mechanism for that?
You're right. He is in a difficult position and he's 1 month on the job. This COP conference has come up a very, you know, prime time, you know, to really push the fund forward. But you're also right in that if you read between the lines of his statement, the money isn't flowing in as expected or actually hasn't come in at all. So, you know, I did ask him that question as well. You know, how will the fund make countries pay up? Because the nature of any fundraising efforts without suitable motivation or penalties, few of the countries will actually meet their pledges. Now, he told me that there isn't a mechanism yet for this. It's a work in progress. And this is how he explained it.
The board will be meeting next month in the Philippines. All the discussion that we are having right now with regard to the access modalities and all the other issues that are important to the fund will be certainly on the table. And I look forward to the guidance and the leadership of the board when we cross the bridge.
Well, just remind us how much exactly is needed by developing countries in order to adapt to the effects of climate change and whether rich countries, and we put that in inverted commas because everybody's being affected by climate change right now, and other donors actually understand the urgency here.
Well, Lori, let me give you some of the numbers that are out there in public. The experts estimate that $30 to $50 billion is needed per year for sub-Saharan Africa alone. This is to fund climate adaptation. And remember, this fund isn't just targeting Africa alone. There are vulnerable countries in other parts of the world, in the Caribbean, in Asia, etc. So, you know, just think of this as a figure that we're working with, but it could be a lot bigger. $700 million is what has been pledged, but developing countries say $400 billion, capital B, is what is needed for loss and damage by 2030. Now, the approach of determining the cost of climate change is a question I also posed to the executive director, and this is what he told me.
The motivation of setting up the fund is that when you look at climate change, you get two types of challenges that we're faced with. That's what I call the human faces and the economic losses. And the human faces, basically the most vulnerable communities across the developing world, were affected with food insecurity and other type of challenges that they face. And the other one is also economic losses, whereby government need to recover, rehabilitate the infrastructure, and rebuild as they develop their countries. So the purpose of the fund is to address both non-economic losses, the economic losses, and that's why ultimately what's really important for us as a fund to make sure that in our intervention, we can actually claim that we saved the lives of the most vulnerable communities in the developing world.
Audrey, that is the thinking of the fund around the cost of climate change. But I also posed a couple of other questions to Mr. Diong. One of them is whether some of the countries that are both pollutants, for example, oil producers, Nigeria, Angola, soon to be Namibia and others, and victims of extreme weather events at the same time, should they claim a piece of the pie?
Something is very important to define here. Our target is the most vulnerable countries that are affected by climate change. And in that process, one thing that's extremely important is to define what we call the vulnerability index, which shows the countries that actually need the support the most. And once that's being done, obviously, it's not one size fits all. And our intention is really to be relevant to all those countries in the open world that are affected by climate change.
So the vulnerability index will be the key determinant of who gets access to this, to some of the funding available in the loss and damage fund, not necessarily the activities of a country, whether they produce pollutants or not.
Indeed. It's also, I have to understand that even within the countries, they're also organizing themselves with their loss and damage strategy, loss and damage plan. So our intention also is to build on those plans and the strategy and the commitment of this country to actually add value to what these countries are doing. So ownership is extremely important. And that's why our intention is to work with the countries and make sure whatever they've been doing for the years and loss and damage, we can come in and add value and strengthen the response mechanism.
How far are you in developing the vulnerability index? Will it draw off other indexes? When might the world see it?
They don't need to be developed by us. They're existing vulnerability index developed by many organizations, which we can actually leverage on.
So that again is Mr. Deong there, very new to the job, barely 2 weeks. He's got a big task ahead of him, doesn't he, Waiga? What's next?
Well, in terms of what next, I'll give you the short-term and the medium-term perspective. Of course, he will be listening to what the conversations are at COP29. It's now day 3 of this conference. And yesterday, African leaders actually put out a fresh appeal. They are demanding $1.3 trillion by 2030 in climate financing from developed countries. Now, all this money might not go to the loss and damage fund, but part of it might. So it will be interesting to see over the coming days at COP how some of these nice quote unquote richer countries will respond to these demands by African leaders, countries like the United States under new leadership. Will they be open to conversations like this? Or will they be hesitant, as they have been in other countries, to conversations around money for climate adaptation in vulnerable countries? So that's short term, a lot of focus on COP. But over the next 2 years, the Fund for Loss and Damage are hoping to have a meeting in Zambia. Why Zambia? Well, the country is currently in the middle of a historic drought. Zambia is working to achieve climate adaptation ambitions. They have a plan, but in the midst of that, there's this drought that they're having to deal with as well. And the board will be meeting there to talk about the loss and damage fund. But also, I believe Zambia will be hoping to showcase what it's doing in terms of climate adaptation. And hopefully there'll be more answers as to how this fund will help, you know, the rest of the world at this board meeting in the next year or so.
Waiga, thank you so much.
Audrey, thank you for your time. Truly appreciate it.
That was Waiga Mwaura talking to me about Ibrahima Sheikh Jong, the man in charge of the Loss and Damage Fund. We are in Sudan now because the United Nations Security Council has sent an expert panel there to investigate alleged war crimes committed by one of the parties to the conflict, the Rapid Support Forces. They'll be looking at killings and attacks committed in Darfur. The area, though, is no stranger to the viciousness of conflict. Back in the early 2000s, the very same Rapid Support Forces, then known as the Janjaweed, were accused of genocide. The generals responsible for those crimes are being sought by the International Criminal Court. At the time, the RSF was operating under the auspices of the Sudan Armed Forces, the very army they are now fighting. Upwards of 15,000 civilians are said to have been killed in this conflict. Thousands of women have been raped and millions of other people have been displaced. Some are on the brink of starvation because they can't grow food and humanitarian aid can't reach them. The thing is, the United Nations panel has been invited in by the Sudan Armed Forces, which is the de facto authority in the country. The panel will investigate charges of war crimes committed by the RSF. But the Sudan Armed Forces are themselves being accused of committing war crimes. So how does this actually work? We turn to Mukesh Kapila, a former United Nations coordinator for Sudan and part of the team that investigated the genocide claims in Darfur more than 20 years ago. What is the United Nations team trying to establish in this investigation?
The UN team has been mandated by the Security Council to investigate the allegations and claims of war crimes and other crimes against humanity and atrocities that have been committed in particularly Darfur.
Is that quite a high bar to establish whether they were war crimes and atrocities?
In a legal criminal sense, yes. We know what is going on in Sudan, and including Darfur, and we have testimonies from many survivors. However, in order to take this forward in some judicial forum, like the International Criminal Court, you got to establish, like with any other crime, when was a crime committed, who committed it, and exactly what's the evidence for that crime having been committed at that particular time. So this is not just confirming broad allegations, but really finding evidence that is going to take us closer to justice and accountability.
And so you'd be looking at specific incidents as well, rather than just this has been happening for the last year and a half or so.
That's right. So normally the evidence collectors would be following up particular reported incidents and trying to geolocate them, trying to define the population that were affected and the perpetrators that were involved, and take evidence and statements from witnesses to those crimes to ascertain their veracity and validity, so as to build up a dossier for these war crimes.
Are they going to be able to go into Sudan, interview people directly, and how will they get access? Because we're talking about an active war zone.
The key problem is really what access they're going to get, and we don't know that yet. All we know is that they've arrived in Port Sudan, where they received some briefings from SAF, the Sudan Armed Forces side. This is the side of the conflict that is in an authoritative position. Now, how this panel is allowed to actually get to the places where these atrocities are most frequent and deep, like in Darfur region itself, is an open question. I very much hope they'll be able to get there.
This mission is investigating war crimes by the Rapid Support Forces, but the Sudanese Armed Forces, which, as you've pointed out, is the de facto authority in Sudan, has also been accused of committing similar crimes in the conflict, and they are the ones that control access right now of the panel to get in and out of Sudan. Why is the mandate so specific? Why doesn't it involve the Sudan Armed Forces as well?
In order for the panel or any group of outsiders to come into the country, you need the consent of whoever is in a position to give that consent. In this case, it happens to be SAF side. And in order for them to actually even get to the stage to be allowed into the country, clearly some compromises had to be done in New York, that they were only going to investigate the other side, i.e. the RSF. So we will get a one-sided and a partial view, but still that view is worth having, even I think it is not the complete picture.
I suppose some people will get justice, but others won't. And that is justice denied, isn't it?
Let's hope that some justice is delivered. I mean, just because we have a fact-finding panel doesn't mean to say that the results of their inquiries, even if it is on one side of the fighting, is going to actually go anywhere, because it'll have to go back to Security Council. They will have to make their own judgment on what the findings are. And on the basis of that, they will have then to decide what to do with it. The only thing the Security Council can do is what happened when I was the UN chief all those years ago, and the first Darfur genocide unfolded. We were able to get a Security Council resolution that allowed referral to the International Criminal Court. Today, because the Security Council is somewhat paralyzed, there's a long, long road ahead before the results of this panel can actually be turned into a resolution of the Security Council and a referral to the Criminal Court. And then the Criminal Court has to act, verify the evidence, collect its own evidence, because a UN Security Council panel is not the same thing as a criminal court investigation. They will accept it as prima facie evidence, but they will have to do their own investigations. And some of this can take years, if not decades.
Just listening to you say how this process unfolds and how captured it is by geopolitical forces at the United Nations, and not forgetting that the Sudanese armed forces were allies and supporters and enablers of the Rapid Support Forces in Darfur, it just seems that impunity wins, power wins, and that, you know, there's this very careful dance around the issue. It's almost as if people need to be seen to be doing something rather than actually doing something. Is that unfair?
No, it's not unfair. It's a description of the reality that we see in the world today, not just in Sudan. We also see that in many other conflicts around the world. We see that in the situation in Palestine, for example, and we have these debates going on at the moment on the war in Ukraine as well. This general climate of impunity, of course, impacts worst on wars in the most poorest and vulnerable countries in the world, of which Sudan is a prime example. The question is, who is responsible? And in this case, the villains are on all sides. There are also the regional actors in Africa and in the Middle East who have been funding and supporting these two sides and profiting from this war, as well as countries taking a calculated interest on which side they want to win in order for them to benefit in the long run.
How come you're not bitter? How come you're not cynical about this process? You've worked in these instances, for, in these situations for so long. You were involved in Darfur 20 more and more years ago.
I was talking to a Sudanese survivor of the Darfur genocide, and is also talking to another survivor on the border between Sudan and South Sudan a little while ago. And these women had been raped. They had terrible atrocities committed upon themselves and their families. And talking to these brave women, they were not bitter. They were not anything other than courageously defiant. And they were, in their own way, carrying on the struggle for the rights to survive, and they were dreaming of a time when this would be over, when this nightmare would be over. Sorry, it brings tears to my eyes just thinking about these two people I met. It suddenly struck me, you know, here I am in a safe place here in Geneva. What right have I got to be either cynical or pessimistic or disillusioned? Because if these people are willing to carry on the struggle and remain hopeful for the future, I think our duty is to side with them and keep up the struggle in whatever way we can.
Mukesh Kapila, United Nations former coordinator for Sudan. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now, as if the people of northwestern Nigeria don't have enough to deal with after years of facing an onslaught by Boko Haram, there is a new threat emerging, yet another Islamist insurgency. It's not entirely new. Dr. Bulama Bukharti is a senior analyst on sub-Saharan Africa and the Sahel, and he's been telling me that the organization first emerged before the pandemic and adopted a softly, softly approach, helping the community deal with armed bandits and so on. And then things changed. A military coup in Niger emboldened them, and now they are menacing the people in the northwest, especially in Kebbi and Sokoto states. Dr. Bukharti began our conversation by telling me more about Lakurawa. How does it differ from other groups that have been operating in northern Nigeria, and who are they?
So it's a new violent extremist group that is espousing an extremist Islamist interpretation. They started entering Nigeria illegally around 2016, 2017. But they would always only stay in Nigeria sporadically for a few months and then return to the Nigerian side of the border. And the information I'm getting so far indicates that they are parts of the groups are fighting in the Sahel, likely an affiliate of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. They move to Nigeria when there is military pressure in the Sahel in order to regroup and recuperate and then return to the Sahel.
Now, we know that Islamic State and Al-Qaeda have different groups that follow them and that they have different intentions on the face of it. So which one is Lakurawa closest to? Or does it not matter in this case?
The Nigerian government says it is affiliated to ISIS, but then quite a few local people mention Al-Qaeda. And to be honest, their modus operandi looks closer to the Al-Qaeda model in the Sahel rather than the ISIS affiliate. Because the Islamic State Sahara province, the ISIS affiliate in the Sahel, is notorious for attacking civilians and killing them indiscriminately. This group tries to court civilians. They are trying to play out the games of hearts and minds in order to win the hearts of local people through preaching, through charity and all that. And that's the Al-Qaeda model rather than the ISIS model.
So what makes them different from other insurgent groups in Nigeria?
Other insurgent groups in Nigeria are broadly divided into three. You have the Boko Haram group and those factions that ensued from the Boko Haram group. You currently have three different factions of Boko Haram that are official. There is an Al-Qaeda affiliate called Ansaru. There is an ISIS affiliate called ISWAP, Islamic State West Africa Province. And there is a faction of Boko Haram that is independent that was under the notorious leader Abubakar Shekau, who died about 2 years ago. Now, in addition to these three big factions, there are smaller groups that have ensued from Boko Haram and who do not seem to be under the command of any of these three. So you could say there are several of those. And then there are bandits, criminal gangs that are locally called bandits, who are engaged in big time abduction and ransom extortion. And they have abducted or killed thousands and thousands of people over the past 10 years and have extorted billions of dollars in ransom across northwestern and north central Nigeria. And then there is the separatist group called the Indigenous People of Biafra, which is IPOB, which has a political motive and whose military wing called the Unknown Gunmen in southeastern Nigeria are also unleashing violence on state forces, government buildings, and mostly northerners that are resident in the south. So you could say these are the broad classifications of armed groups. But along with that, there are communal clashes that continue. For example, there is a farmer herder crisis that is still consuming lives from time to time in north central Nigeria, in places like Plateau State and Benue State, where you have farmers who happen to be mainly Christians clashing with herders who happen to be mainly Muslims.
You said that they seem to be coming from Niger, and when there's military pressure on the other side of the border, they move across to Nigeria. But I thought that those parts of the world were, you know, very porous and people could fit on either side of any border because those borders are meaningless.
That's broadly correct if you are talking about the immediate border communities. Even in their case, accent and intonation would differ even when they are speaking the same language. But in this case, we are talking about people who are in the Sahel, and the Sahel doesn't border northwestern Nigeria directly. And so they are moving from the Sahel to northwestern Nigeria. And so even the Nigerian part of the border is foreign to them. In addition to that, they are languages that are not found in Nigeria, like the Berber ethnic group that are called Buzae in the local language, or you could call them the Tuaregs. There are Arabs, white Arabs or fair-skinned Arabs who are known to be natives of northwestern Nigeria. And they don't speak the local language. They don't speak Hausa. Very few of them reportedly speak Fulfulde, which is common in northwestern Nigeria. Instead, they speak Arabic, French, and they speak the Tuareg language.
They're also replacing key personnel, leaders and so on, are they?
Yes, they are. And when the relationship started initially, you could say it was smooth. But I think it was only smooth because the Nigeria police force said they were not a threat. Because in 2018, the communities reported to the police, and this is public information reported by major Nigerian newspapers, that there are new foreign-looking people speaking a foreign language carrying arms around their communities. The Nigeria police force investigated, and they held a press conference and said, "We have investigated. These people, even though armed, are not a threat." For me, it's incredible that the police would say foreigners wielding weapons in your country are not a threat.
And in such a volatile part of the country as well.
Exactly. A volatile part of the country, not just because of the endemic insecurity that has been raging for many years, but also because of the gold deposit in that part of the country and the porous borders you and I were talking about. And so communities had no option but to live with them. And if you just did a simple Google search, you would see the police addressing the media on this issue. And so communities continue to live with them. And like I said, now, this group now felt the best way to be accepted by the locals is to solve their problem. And their biggest problem is insecurity from the criminal gangs called bandits. And so they said, look, we are going to help you fight the bandits. And these are communities that are frustrated that the Nigerian government has woefully failed to fight this insecurity from the bandits. And so they started helping locals to fight bandits, and they dropped bandits out of the area where they operate, especially in some local councils in Sokoto State and Kebbi State, both in northwestern Nigeria. In exchange of that security they provide, they started taxing local communities, especially herders. They paid them in cows and sheep and goats, and now they are starting to charge them in cash, because it is becoming difficult for them to keep the animals or to sell the animals. And then they started enforcing their laws, their strict, narrow, rap interpretation of Islam. They ban music, they ban cigarettes, they encourage wearing beards and dress codes. That was what actually led to the latest clash that led to the headlines in the media.
Oh yeah, I was about to ask you, how have local residents been responding to this?
If you live in northwestern Nigeria, you just can't raise your finger against these groups, because you know that the Nigerian security forces have failed to protect you. If your village is found wanting by these groups, it can be erased over a period of hours, and nobody is there to protect anyone. And therefore, out of fear, communities just keep quiet. Some of them pay money to these groups to live in peace. And right now, communities are still not responding violently, except in this one case that we are talking about, because these are heavily armed people, and many estimates say they are in hundreds, and they have shown example with even traditional rulers who defied their authorities. They killed traditional rulers who defied their authorities. But in this specific case, the entire animal belonging to a particular village, over 100 cows and smaller animals, was confiscated by this group. And the youth in the village trooped out to the outskirts of the village in order to fight back and get their animals. And that was where this incident happened. Now 17 people died in the process. Several of the Lakurao fighters are reported to have been killed, but there is no evidence to show that. And now fear is spreading even more in the part of a country that is already devastated by criminal violence. People are very concerned for their safety. Some are even looking for a way to leave their communities because of this group.
That's Dr. Bulama Bukharji, Senior Analyst on Sub-Saharan Africa. Focus on Africa was compiled by Susan Gashui and Charles Gitonga in Nairobi. Bella Hassan is here in London. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Philip Bull was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. And we have a YouTube channel. Did you know that? Well, you know what to do. Before I go, a quick reminder that you should listen to our sister podcast, Africa Daily. The latest episode discusses why bride price is causing a headache for Congolese couples. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.